Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
And welcome back to the Unforgiving 60. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host Ben Pronk.
G'day, Tim.
And Ben, we are crossing over from the first battlefield into the second battlefield in this episode where we take the principles of war and apply them into a corporate context.
We are.
Well, there being nothing more to be said, let's get on with the show.
Sorry, you stumped me. I didn't know what to say.
So, Tim, in this episode, we're going to look at the principles of war and how they might apply to the business environment, which you've referred to as the second battlefield, or indeed, I reckon, many other endeavours. I guess the first thing we need to do is remember deep back into our RMC past, the Royal Military College, where we first got exposed to these, and try to remember what the 10 principles of war according to the Australian Army are.
Or maybe even before that, into the early 19th century, to Karl von Clausewitz, who started shaping the principles of war, Ben.
You want to go that far back?
Let's go a long way back.
So Clausewitz, as we all know, one of the sort of godfathers of modern military strategy. He was a Prussian military theorist and a soldier in his own right. And his seminal work was a tome called On War, which actually wasn't published in his lifetime. It was cobbled together, as I recall, by his wife posthumously, and is become a bit of a timeless classic. And there is so much goodness that comes out of Clausewitz's book On War. And as you said, really has shaped a lot of modern military thought.
And he deliberately wrote it to be agnostic to time, threat, and technology. And he deliberately wrote it to be timeless.
Yeah, and one of the things that Clausewitz makes the distinction between is the nature and the character of war. And he talks about the nature of war being enduring, that it does not change, and yet the character changes quite profoundly. And we've seen that a lot. We've seen the whole evolution through a lot of it's technologically driven, but through that 19th century into things like gunpowder-initiated firearms, things like automatic weapons in the First World War, driving changes in tactics all the way up through to hybrid warfare, three-block warfare, and of course nuclear weapons along the way.
And probably this new dimension of artificial intelligence and robotics that might remove humans from various parts of the battlefield.
Another great example of the changing character, however, the enduring nature. And a lot of what Clausewitz talks about, the violence, primordial violence, that balance between rationality and chance, between the desires of the people and the rule of the government, all of these sort of factors have proved to be quite timeless.
Now, you love my trivia questions. Here's a Karl von Clausewitz trivia question. What is the remarkable trinity?
I alluded to a couple of those before, and it is three points that Clausewitz says are held in tension, like you can imagine magnets sort of with forces pulling against one another. And the three poles of those magnets, the first one is primordial violence, hatred, and enmity. He talks about that as being this idea of passion, a real almost a rational sort of violent emotion. The second one is the play of chance and probability. So this idea of rolling the dice. And we've spoken a lot about the unpredictability of outcomes in complex scenarios. Mm. And sometimes it is just luck. It's just the butterfly effect. It is these kind of unpredictable factors that will have a massive material impact on the outcome.
And as you're acting, others are reacting. You can't control everything. Where you interface with environmental conditions, that changes. Human behaviours, of course, change as well.
Yeah. And the third one is war's element of subordination as an instrument of policy. I've mentioned that in a previous RV, but this talks about this idea of reason. So the Clausewitzian trinity are these concepts of passion or violence, chance and reason, and the interplay that they have to ultimately impact the outcome of any kind of human conflict.
So he talks danger, he talks uncertainty, he talks chance, and he talks an F word.
Friction.
Friction.
We We have spoken about friction before in...
Yes.
In the podcast.
Yes, we have.
Great. And I mentioned before, there's so much goodness to come out of On War. One of my personal favourites is his timeless quote that in war, everything is simple, mm-hmm. but even the simplest things are difficult. And I reckon that's similar to another of our favourite quotes from George Orwell about this idea of things seeming very clear from a distance, but the closer you get, the vaguer they become. There are these concepts that seem very easy to do. Seize the hill, march to that point, meet the helicopters on the landing zone. All of these things, when you're planning them in a nice air-conditioned room, seem to be so simple as to hardly warrant planning. And of course, once those frictions come in, they can become very difficult.
And the force that makes the apparently easy so difficult is the friction. And some of the frictions that he cites in On War include, not surprisingly, the enemy, who have an opinion.
Enemy gets a vote.
Yeah, enemy gets a vote. And what did Tolstoy say? You might not like war.
Might not be interested in war, but war is interested in you.
Tolstoy say, you might not be interested in war, but war is interested in you.
But sorry to interrupt you, Tim, but this is a fantastic...
No, sorry for speaking while you're interrupting.
My stuff is generally better, so for our listeners' sake. This is a fantastic point that you can't just choose when to dip in and out of these kind of issues. And in fact, the very genesis of this concept of wicked problems, a paper in the 70s by, I'm going to say, Weber and Horst, lists these 10 defining characteristics of wicked problems. Mm. And one of them is just exactly that. They have no stopping rule.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, other factors being weather and terrain. I mean, you can often select the ground of your own choosing, but not necessarily the time at which you might be impacted.
However, as former officers of the Royal Australian Infantry Corps, we would do our mission regardless of season
weather or terrain. Absolutely. Tim's next trivia question to you.
Mm-hmm.
What is the role of the infantry?
The role of the infantry, Tim, is to seek out and close with the enemy, to kill or capture him. Very gender specific. To kill or capture him, to seize and hold ground. No, to clear... To seize and hold ground and repel attack by day or by night, regardless of season, weather or terrain.
I'll give you about 60%. You'd probably get a fail on your infantry course.
Yelled at by a drill sergeant.
So we talk about that terrain influence. We talk about inadequate or inaccurate information, right? And the other thing that's often omitted is human error.
Yeah.
And what, in actual fact, what Army doctrine says is that all of those things can be mitigated to a degree with good leadership, sound operational experience, and good
training.
Initiative.
Yep, yep.
Yeah. Okay, so what's the corporate relevance in Karl von Clausewitz's On War with his friction, with his uncertainty, with the principle of chance, free and creative will... even perhaps reflecting on that remarkable trinity. What's the relevance? How is that relevant to the corporate?
Well, let's look at Clausewitz's Holy Trinity. So I think they are equally, and, you know, just as the nature of war is enduring, so too are the nature of these characteristics applicable across more than just warfare. I think they're applicable across most of human endeavour, that there is going to be an element of passion. And this comes into discussions we've had before about the irrationality of humans. We both love Richard Thaler's work on behavioral economics, and the fact that we're not particularly rational actors, that we're
completely irrational, driving irrational behavior in markets.
Yep. And so that is obviously a very clear example of a link there from Clausewitz to the business environment.
And even Thaler, talking economics, talks about the SIFs, the supposedly irrelevant factors, those what we would describe as weak signals that for the most part would get ignored, but good close behavioural economists pay particular attention to them.
Yes. They can definitely have disproportionate impacts. And that comes also into this concept of chance, the randomness, the throw of the dice, all of those sorts of things are factors that are going to impact the outcome of any event. And to ignore those, to plan in a world where you expect things to be clinical and not influenced by just plain bad luck, timing, etc., is folly.
So instead of reading Leadership Secrets of Attila the Hun, maybe corporates could get some value out of reading Clausewitz on War?
It's dense. It is a super dense. It is not an easy read, particularly book two. Maybe that's a job for us. Contemporize it. Make a buck out of it.
Probably wouldn't make much more than a buck out of it.
Yeah, I wonder who's got his IP.
If someone wants to pre-order our version, Clausewitz on War for corporates, let us know.
Yeah. But yeah, so we covered chance, we covered passion, and then rationality or reason, this idea of being subordinate, it still plays a part. We do need to have functioning hierarchical structures in a lot of organisations. We don't want to be slaves to them, but we need to be able to cascade missions down. We need to be able to have that command, control, and management working in order for the machine to keep pushing forward.
So onto the principles of war. And there are principles of war embraced by the British. They have some 10. The Americans have 9 principles of war. And we're actually going to focus on the Australian principles of war only because we know them a little better. And the first is selection and maintenance of the aim, which is all about ensuring that the end state remains clearly in view and tasks that you undertake at varying levels are relevant at other varying levels.
We should just refer people back to our episode, Mission is Nothing, Intent is Everything.
That's right.
We did definitely cover that, and we're both firm believers in that idea. This concept of not micromanaging, of not telling people how to do their jobs, but telling them what to do, and importantly, why they're doing it. And that really is that selection and maintenance of the aim. I'd add communication of the aim. We'll talk about communication in a second, but it's important in there that we do cascade that aim, that vision, that mission, use them interchangeably or appropriately within the organisation, but we cascade what we're trying to do down so that there is a golden thread of logic between what reads on our corporate mission statement and what people are doing day to day in our organisation.
It's taking me back to the Royal Military College, into the model room, talking tactics. You need to rote learn the principles of war.
So maybe we can paint a verbal picture. We did a lot of the tactics training at RMC, Royal Military College Duntroon, in this model room, and it had tiered seating on 3 sides and often a mud model, so a scaled three-dimensional map of a piece of terrain on the ground, and we'd have these wonderful instructors talking us through either historical battles or hypothetical battles, often fighting the Missourians.
Yeah, the fictitious enemy, the Missourians.
The training enemy. And
they were not very smart enemy.
No, although they defeated me on many occasions, despite their lack of tactical flair. But yeah, really, I mean, obviously, RMC is a fantastic product. It spits out a pretty good junior officer by global standards. And yeah, that was a big part of it, learning the craft of military leadership.
I was sinking as low into my allocated seat, because you had allocated seats and you never moved, but I was sinking as low into my allocated seat as I could, so I did not get asked the question, what's the second principle of war? And I can tell you right now that the second principle of war is a concentration of force. So it's the ability to apply effort at the right place at the right time. Relevance for corporates?
It almost stands on its own, you know, definition, as you just said. We don't want to be spreading ourselves too thin. I think this idea in a corporate sense of working out what our target market is, in a commercial sense, you know, where do we want to be applying our effort? Because we can't be all things to all people. And these ideas of hitting those niches or concentrating your efforts in a particular area, be that geographic, be it, you know, product space, you know, goes without saying. I think this is well and truly embraced by the corporate side.
And certainly there are finite resources, and being able to apply those finite resources against any main effort on any particular in any particular period of time is important. Mm. And concentration of force includes locations that are non-contiguous. It includes teams that are dispersed or disaggregated, and their ability to provide mutual support. So it's not necessarily limited to a
like a
physical
space.
Piece of topography.
Yeah, And that harks back to that first point. All of those different, particularly in a dispersed sense or a decentralized sense, they all need to know what the aim is. So they're all working in concert. They're concentrated on the same effort, even if they're not physically co-located.
Hmm. Good project teamwork here, actually, we see in many of our clients that bring specialists in for a particular project. And when the project is over, that is, you have applied your force at the right place at the right time, the project team breaks up and people go back to their parent subgroups.
And I wonder if we're not going to see a lot more of that in this, you know, the rapidity of change in the contemporary business world, the fourth industrial revolution.
We presented on the fourth industrial revolution a few weeks ago.
Yep. And, you know, these ideas that there is so much cutting edge expertise, you know, particularly as we look at some of the technological advances, that we can't possibly hope to own that all in our organisation, but we are going to need to access it.
Mm.
And so that idea of being able to concentrate force, even if it's not within your own company, but be able to bring people in the right skills at the right time on a particular goal and then disperse when required, I think it's increasingly important.
And maybe co-location of workforce is going to become less relevant as well.
Yeah, and which presents a great, a fantastic challenge for leaders, because that inability to manage by physically walking around, but you still want to be able to get those concepts of team, those ideas of, you know, collective goal, shared common identity in a professional sense, even with people who aren't wearing the same logo on their T-shirts, then, it presents more challenges for leaders.
You know, we talk and train inside management groups inside a virtual crisis management environment. That is being able to harness the expertise, regardless of where that expertise happens to be around the planet in your particular organization or outside, to get the best possible result. But we also talk about the virtual leadership environment.
Mm.
And that's going to become increasingly important with disparate workforces driven by this fourth industrial revolution that are separated by timeframes in which, you know, time zones prohibit common regular interfaces potentially, Ben.
Hmm. Now, Tim, the third principle of war is cooperation, which is a good one.
And we don't get much of that on this particular podcast.
Tim, I was actually leading up to say we cooperate very well.
Yeah, and this is, again, harnessing resources and energy in order to make sure that that concentration of force can be achieved. So I think there's direct synergies with the concentration of force component.
And linked again into that common understanding of the aim, being on that same mental model so that you can concentrate efforts and cooperate. And I think this idea of cooperation inherent in that is a complementarity, that we're not all doing the same thing at the same time, but we're using relative strengths and weaknesses together to try and achieve that goal. And I think this is a big one from a leadership perspective as well. It would be great if we could all be leaders that are fantastically visionary and inspirational, wonderful communicators, also very precise program managers that are able to get those Gantt charts and spreadsheets working, as well as communicate effectively at all levels in the organization. Outside of probably you and I, Tim, I'm yet to see sort of that exist.
Spreadsheet skills.
I joke, of course. Very few people have all of those skills in one individual. And so that's where you want to harness a leadership team. You want to get a command team that can cooperate and have that complementarity of skills and attributes to achieve the organisational goals.
And this third principle, cooperation as a principle of war, also talks to the joint combined arms component and the interagency or the interdepartmental cooperation. We've previously done the episode with Alex Lloyd at Life on the Line podcast about the Pongsu mission that we were involved in, that had a variety of different stakeholders, participants that were fused into planning to get the best possible mission result.
I'm trying really hard to bring that across to a business context. Do you need air support in many business ventures?
Offshore oil and gas, you need a lot of air support.
Fire support?
Fire support, less relevant unless we're talking a fire hose.
Moving on.
Yeah, but that cooperation, I think, is important, because we're talking about, again, being able to work interdepartmentally inside your organisation, but also with consultants, contractors, specialists that may appear for certain time frames. It need to be fused into the organizational culture. They need to understand the project plan, mm-hmm. the deliverables, the tasks, the objectives, and be held accountable to that. So cooperation is incredibly important inside the corporate world. Dare I say it, it's bleedingly obvious.
Less gunships.
The fourth principle is economy of effort.
That's my forte.
So again, prudent allocation and application, what we would call efficient and effective. You can't have an efficient economy of effort if it's not particularly effective, and you wouldn't want to have an effective economy of effort if it wasn't particularly efficient. It has to be constructed in the right particular way.
So we spoke about von Clausewitz before. One of his peers was a guy called Helmut von Moltke the Elder, another Prussian military guru. And he has this wonderful, or had this wonderful mechanism of characterizing his junior officers. And he'd assess them against intelligence and industriousness. And to cut a long story short, he thought that when you identified someone who was smart and lazy, that they made the best generals. They would come up with these elegant solutions because they were too lazy to do all the legwork. They'd think of a smarter way. And I reckon that speaks to economy of effort.
Okay, economy of effort. Main effort and supporting efforts inside the military context. How many main efforts could you have?
Uno solamente.
You can only have one, and then a variety of supporting efforts. And so the beauty of having economy of effort in your supporting efforts is you would be able to swing some resources across to that particular main effort, which would present for an opportunity or a period of time.
And it prevents you from throwing good money after bad. If you're clear on what your main effort is and you're bogging down on one of the supporting efforts, then it makes it a little easier to reprioritize, because you don't want to devote a whole bunch of time, money and resources to something that's not the main game.
We're on to principle of war number 5, and it is security. So this is really protection of oneself, and in a military context, that's hardly startling. It is best in the military context obtained by offensive operations, the creation of a security bubble, by threatening the enemy's security. So that dislocation, the application of maneuver theory that denies, deters an enemy's ability to use its capabilities against you. Security in the corporate context.
The idea of not putting all your, you know, not betting the house on any single sort of endeavor, the idea of having a, as Dave Snowden would put it, a safe fail experiment, rather than trying to bet the house on a fail safe design, I think that's really important. We see things like hedging mechanisms, these kind of things from a financial sense, that are trying to build in some kind of security in terms of what we're doing. I think the point that we're trying to make is that this doesn't come for free. You need to devote resources, devote attention, devote time to building in those security mechanisms for just that reason, to provide a safety net.
And security of information prior to a decision being made. And only today, we're inside the walls of an ASX top 15 company, and they were going through some due diligence, and the levels of protection on the information inside that particular due diligence before an investment decision's made, quite strict.
Rightly so. And, you know, increasingly we talk about cyber and the cyber threat and all that sort of thing. The paradox for me is that most of the successful cyber attacks don't go through your hardware, your software, they go through your people. And so in many ways, this concept of corporate security is more a function of leadership than it is of a technological solution. Getting our people attuned to having good security practices, both electronic and physical.
Principle of war number 6 is offensive action. Now, military forces take offensive action to gain and retain an initiative. I talked about the dislocation of an enemy force, but to wrong foot them in order to maximize the opportunity that presents inside a particular window. And we would teach inside the military against that principle of war that offensive action must be swift, it must be decisive, and it must also be directed towards the achievement of, in the military, what is called the end state.
So the end state links directly back to this ongoing discussion we have about your organisational vision and making sure that everyone is aware of what you're working towards. So that's clear. And we talk about manoeuvre theory. Now, manoeuvre theory is opposed to theories of attrition, which were fairly commonly held in the 19th
Napoleonic
century.
And yep. Stalingrad, World War II.
Where you're simply throwing resources at one another with an idea of attriting them to such point that the last person standing is the one who wins. Maneuver theory is based on in my sort of read of it, the more sort of Sun Tzu based ideas of surfaces and gaps. Why would you throw effort at what is patently a surface, a well defended in a military sense position, when you could try and pick a gap? And in a business sense, I think this translates quite well. You know, why would you go up against Google with a search engine? You know, if someone is so entrenched in a product, then maybe you need to be looking for that gap. And I think things like the development of the iPad, you know, something that nobody wanted, needed, or was asking for, presents in many ways the identification of a gap. That was very successful.
Telephone companies kind of do this well. They're not mimicking each other. They're looking to the next new dimension where the consumer will seize on something that's particularly new, not a higher powered phone, not necessarily a better performing camera, but something that's super unique.
And the idea of offensive action, it doesn't necessarily mean constantly hurtling headlong towards a goal. I think it's more this concept of a spirit that you're pushing forward. It's not necessarily offensive in, you know, giving offense. It's just being on the front foot and trying something new. And in many ways, it's about that ethos of not giving up, of always sort of pushing forward.
I love that maneuver theory and an application in the corporate world. Well, we're seeing a little bit of it, certainly in terms of accretive work, acquisitions, as people start to focus more on what's coming into the near horizon, electric vehicles, what might be feeding them in terms of raw material and the processing component, looking at some of the downstream applications. So, yeah, really to be a market leader, to get ahead of that particular trend is one really good example of some of the companies that are being truly maneuverist. Okay, principle of war number 7 is surprise, which can produce results disproportionate to the rate of effort. Would you agree?
Yes. There's a wonderful book by a guy called Bill McRaven, who is a very famous American Special Operations Admiral. And McRaven, early in his career, wrote a book called Spec Ops, which looks at case studies of special operations actions throughout history. And he hinges on this idea that relative surprise is a massive factor, or relative superiority, rather, which is heavily based on this concept of surprise, is a massive factor in the success of special operations in many of these cases. And the idea that you can have a small force hitting hard without warning, producing a disproportionate effect, and then evaporating off into the night, is at the basis of a lot of these concepts. He notes, however, that the longer that small force hangs around, and the more that the surprise wears off, their relative superiority plummets, and they end up in many cases very vulnerable. So certainly from that perspective, in a military context, surprise is invaluable. What about in a business context, Tim?
Well, we talk about the link between surprise and its three-bar relationship with security. The classic example is information. So if you can maintain information security, you can achieve some level of surprise. I mean, again, telephone companies are doing this really well. No one knows too much about the next Apple iPhone until the release day. You know, there's an element of surprise in that because they've maintained good security. Now, the other point about surprise is that, of course, we can't conceal all activities. It's physically impossible in the military world and in the corporate world to do that. And so what's done particularly well inside the military environment is this deception, the misinformation, the disinformation that conceals ultimately the intent of any planned action. And within legal limits, and ethical and moral limits, you could potentially do that inside the corporate world as well, so that you can achieve this principle of war being surprise.
Yeah. Now, the 8th principle of war, Tim, is my personal favourite.
Yes.
Flexibility.
Yes. Now, does this mean touching your toes?
No.
Because you can't do that.
I cannot. Is that a principle? Is touching your toes? Is that
no? But flexibility.
Flexibility is.
Just mean more yoga.
The reason I like flexibility as a principle of war is because whenever in my training life, when I was a cadet at RMC and even into time in the battalion, whenever something stuffed up, the trucks didn't arrive, someone hadn't booked something and would say we had to change at the last minute, I was told by a surly drill sergeant, flexibility is the eighth principle of war, which means we're going to stuff you around, but you know it's a principle of war, so suck it up. So I like that, flexibility.
And probably inside of that, holding a small amount of reserve so you can have some flex.
Mm.
I mean, the businesses we've run, Ben, you know, we talk about lean plus 10%. Everyone wants to run a super lean organization. It's not always great in terms of the amount of flexibility it does not offer you.
Mm.
So lean plus 10% is often a great way to go.
And look, later in my career within Special Operations Command, they talk about these ideas of flexibility, agility, and adaptability. The idea of flexibility is you can do a whole bunch of different things. The idea of agility is you can bounce between those different things relatively quickly. And the idea of adaptability is you can take those skills that you have got, that whole range of skills you've got, and adapt them, change them to meet the demands of a novel challenge. And I reckon that's a pretty good way of looking at organisational structure. You know, you are obviously going to have various specialities, but you kind of don't want to be a one-trick pony. You want to, like our friend Robert Heinlein's quote, specialisation is for insects. You want to have a bit of diversity, a bit of flexibility in what you can do. But importantly, you want to be able to change between those skills with relative speed.
Mm.
And increasingly importantly, you need to be able to adapt those skills to meet new challenges.
And flexibility enables you to seek and certainly seize those fleeting opportunities. And what guides flexibility? It comes back to that intent. So what enables me to exhibit flexibility with a degree of initiative in an environment where I don't have to seek permission, as long as I'm working inside the intent, I can move forward and do that.
Hmm.
Principle number 9 is sustainment. We've probably never been particularly interested as former infantry officers and SAS, ex-SAS guys about sustainment outside of what we carry on our back. But this is really the ability to ensure that operational plans, the execution of tasks, missions, whether it be in the military environment or the corporate world, that those missions and tasks are well supported. So it's largely about logistics and personnel.
100%. And in fact, General Omar Brady was very famous for saying that amateurs talk tactics and professionals talk logistics. This is critical, as anyone who's tried to fight the Russians in winter would tell you. The tactics last a whole lot longer than the logistics or the sustainment.
Napoleon tried that?
Yes. Yes, he did.
Failed badly?
He did.
And
Hitler also tried it.
Tried that?
Yep.
Didn't read his history.
Correct.
Oh, badly.
Yep. General Winter defeated both of them. But this is the point we're making. It is easy to come up with the flashy front-end idea or concept or the new product or the great new offering. However, if you cannot sustain it, if you do not have the back-end logistics, if you haven't got the working capital, if you haven't thought about the distribution networks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then it will undoubtedly end in failure.
A saying attributed to Napoleon Bonaparte, an army marches on its stomach. To be effective, an army relies on good and plentiful food.
Interesting that he'd say that in light of 1812. But bear in mind, he was then thinking that he could get that food off the lands that he'd plummet as he went through, and of course that wasn't so successful in the winter in Russia.
Now, in our time in SAS patrols, good and plentiful food?
You can have one or the other.
I'm not sure you can have either. Good and plentiful food. So that's sustainment. And the last one, principle number 10, is maintenance of morale. We talk about morale being one-third of combat power.
Mm-hmm.
Thoughts on the importance of morale, Ben? I try and keep yours down as much as I possibly can.
And you do very well.
Yes.
Morale, critical. The military sense, there have been countless military examples where a highly efficient, smaller, numerically smaller force has overcome a larger force based almost entirely on this principle of morale. And I reckon in a business sense, this goes even more than just organizational effectiveness. We spend a lot of our time working. It is kind of the thing we do the most, the single activity that we do the most throughout our lives. And if we're not enjoying it, what's the point? So I think this idea of morale should really be underpinning, and its link to effectiveness is obviously recognized within the military context, but potentially not always recognized in the corporate environment where we've got these KPIs and metrics and all these sorts of things we measure ourselves by. I think it is prudent to remember the importance of morale as a combat enabler, as a force enabler.
And recognize also that some of the artificialities of morale, you know, good coffee beans in the coffee machine, it's very superficial. I mean, good morale is guided by good leadership, by clear communications, by the empowerment of individuals, the enablement of initiative.
The provision of a sense of purpose is massive as well. Yeah, it is funny. I think in many cases, I think generally we're getting better, but, you know, money as a proxy for morale doesn't really work. I mean, you know, that is obviously not the only driver that keeps people motivated. And in many cases, it can't make up for shortfalls in the areas that you mentioned, Tim.
Now, over the years, many people have written about an 11th principle of war being media, because media, well managed through operational campaigns, generally creates a value add. Media that's poorly managed has a complete negative effect on the whole of that particular operation. Now, the changing face of media, we explored a little bit with Simon Bailey in ordering your life and your messages. Thoughts on media, or the broader definition of media as an 11th principle of war?
I think it's a good one, and it is very relevant in the business context as well. And maybe if we can expand media to be stakeholder engagement.
Yes.
Whether media is an audience or it's a vector, it's a wonderful philosophical discussion. Are you, you know, engaging with the media, or are you engaging with other audiences through the media? But the idea of being able to communicate is got to be central to everything that you do. It is such an important part of leadership, being able to get the message across in a manner that's appropriate to both the context and the followers. It needs to be pertinent to the environment and pertinent to the people who are receiving it. And sometimes we forget about that. Sometimes we're so, because when we're involved in a situation, in an organization, we know all the facts, we know all the background, we know all the context, we know that we're good people trying to do a good job. We forget that the rest of the world may not necessarily see that, particularly the external stakeholders. And so this idea of media, and if we extend that to talk about stakeholders. Is one that is very worth adding as our 11th principle.
Yeah, agree. I like the stakeholder engagement and creating themes and messages, and importantly, communicating them. And if good communication sits inside good stakeholder management, you would find that 11th principle would permeate most of the other principles of war. Media is a very narrow term, and even though we've written essay after essay on how we would best employ good media management through combat operations, the harsh cold reality of the year 2019 is that media are a bearer to stakeholders. You can choose to communicate through them or not, but there's the rise of the citizen journalist, and everyone, we think of this thing that's in our pockets or on our desks as a telephone, but it's actually an incredibly powerful and sophisticated computer system that can publish messages, images, video to the world right now. And in the court of public opinion, two data points make a trend, and those citizen journalists carry some weight. And we saw, in fact, we've seen globally in incidents in London and Mumbai, I'm talking specific terrorist incidents, certainly in Christchurch, the recent tragic events in Christchurch, where social media has been a very powerful bearer. And the management of that inside the stakeholder outreach thing, I think, would be highly beneficial.
So, Tim, we've done 11 Principles of War. 10 plus 1.
Always go a little further.
Did we, what do you reckon, all 11 have something to offer in the wider corporate sense?
Well, let's go through them. The first was selection and maintenance of the aim.
Yep.
Concentration of force.
Mm-hmm.
Cooperation.
Very much.
Economy of effort.
My forte.
Security.
Yep.
Including information security. Yep. Offensive action, so the need to gain and retain an initiative, and probably a market initiative is important.
Yep.
Surprise, relating to security, and we included deception inside surprise.
Yes.
Flexibility.
My favourite.
Sustainment. Maintenance of morale. And then our plus one was the stakeholder component.
Clean sweep.
Clean sweep. Yeah. I think there is applicability. And for those out there that are pondering those 10 plus one, you could apply them inside your organization and work out whether there was one, two, or more that potentially you needed to reinforce a little.
But as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. And yeah, let us know what you reckon. Hopefully there's been some value in going through those and some applicability in terms of you fulfilling your Unforgiving 60s.
Tell me, do you listen while other people lie in your bed? Tell me a reason why I should disclose the things in my head. I got a feeling it comes to me from I don't know where. I love you and I'll be there.
There's a wonderful book by a guy called Bill McRaven, who is a very famous American Special Operations Admiral. What was his book called?
Hard to tell.
Tell me, do you understand? Do you lie in wishes?
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence on Unforgiving 60, and we want your insights and feedback. And indeed, if you know someone who has great insights to share with us that have a practical difference, then get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. We love speaking to anyone who's been walking on the path less travelled and is generally living the life less ordinary. And if you like the podcast, please rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search at unforgiving60, that's unforgiving60. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, you know what to do. See you next episode on the Unforgiving 60.